more than anything else, made me lasso a thin rope from my balcony and slither down it. My bare feet landed on the grass. Locke took both my hands and looked me over with a smile that managed to be complimentary and slightly, amusingly lewd. I giggled, despite myself.
"It was hard to stay away from you,"
he said. "You shouldn't have. It was part of his charm somehow, to get me to say the things I meant."
"We, the folk, don't love like you do,"
Locke said.
"Perhaps you shouldn't trust me with your heart. I might break it."
I didn't like that. Cardin knows it was me you were meeting. He told me as much.
"Ah,"
he said. Just that. I took a few steps from him and crossed my arms over my chest. "Leave Jude out of this." He gave me a fox's grin.
"Cardin certainly does seem to enjoy hurting her, doesn't he?"
It was true, and awful. Even if I could persuade you to stop reacting, impossible enough. The prince had to be angry about being slammed into a tree. She can't win.
"Can't she?"
he asked. I hated the way he questioned me, as though you were so much more interesting than I was. I was the good sister, the one who kept faith and stuck to the rules. You were the angry one, the one who didn't know how far was far enough, the one who courted disaster. It wasn't fair. You won't even go against him. How could she have any chance? Locke laughed at that.
"There it is, that temper you try to hide. You know what fascinates me about you? You're a hungry person sitting in front of a banquet, refusing to eat."
I thought of the banquets of Faerie, of Everapple, the fruit that makes mortals give in to abandon. I thought of the banquets I'd only heard of, where the folk enchant humans and serve up garbage glamored to look like delicacies, where they crown one of them the Queen of Mirth, a title that comes with robes of filth and horrible mockery. How could he doubt why I would hesitate to eat at such a banquet?
"Aren't you ever careless?"
he asked. "Always with you."
"I want to show you something,"
Locke said, taking my hand.
"Come with me."
"I'm not wearing," I began. But he led me toward the woods.
"It doesn't matter,"
he said.
"No one will mind."
I stopped moving, horrified. Who is going to be there? I don't think this is a good idea. I didn't even have shoes.
"Will you trust me?"
Locke asked. There was so much in that question. When I thought back to the time before that first note, my life seemed to have been dry paper, waiting for him to kindle it.
"No,
not him. Love." "Yes," I said, taking his hand. "For tonight." There was a revel near the Lake of Masks. A few folk cavorted under the stars and stretched out on carpets. I didn't recognize any of them. They didn't attend the palace school, and if I'd seen them before, it had only been in passing. They seemed to know Locke, though, and called out to him. One played a fiddle, and when he saw us, he began playing a song I'd heard before in the mortal world. Locke twirled me in his arms, and for those moments, everything was perfect. We danced three dances like that, my body becoming looser, my steps less formal. Then we rested on the grass, sharing a glass of spiced wine from a borrowed wood cup. Then Locke pointed to a boy with hair the impossibly bright green of new leaves.
"He keeps looking at you."
"Because I'm in my nightgown," I said.
"Go speak with him,"
Locke said cryptically. I gave him an incredulous look, but he only raised his brows and smiled.
"It will be easy once it's begun."
"What will?" I asked.
"Go,"
he urged, looking impish. And so I forced myself to stand and to make my way over the grass. The boy looked surprised as I drew closer, then stood up, dusting off his homespun tunic. Reed pipes hung from a leather cord around his neck.
"The general's daughter,"
he said, and bowed.
"Sometimes, when the leaves are thin, we can see the lights of your stronghold from here."
"And sometimes I can hear music from my balcony. Were you the player?" He blushed. He must have been green-blooded, because his cheeks and neck were abruptly suffused with that color.
"If it pleased you, then I'd like to claim it was mine."
And to what name ought I direct my praise? Locke was right about one thing. It was easy. The boy was nice. But I didn't understand what I was supposed to be doing.
"Adir,"
he said.
"But you can call me whatever you want, if you will consent to dance with me."
So we danced, his shy hand on my hip. Locke watched. The fiddler pranced around as he played. Revelers in rags, leaves in their hair, whirled and jumped. I laughed. This was just the sort of thing that Oriana would hate. She wouldn't like me venturing out alone, my pockets empty of salt. She wouldn't like me dancing, especially with folk who were not courtiers. But despite that, despite the strangeness of the situation, I was having fun.
"I hope you didn't get bored without me,"
Locke interrupted, surprising me. I hadn't noticed when he got up. A moment later, he was pulling me into his arms for a kiss. Then he turned to Adir.
"He looks amusing enough. Was he?"
Hurt flashed across the boy's face. His mouth crumpled. "Very amusing," I said. Only after the words left my mouth did I realize how dismissive they sounded. Like Nicasia or Prince Cardan himself. But for a moment, it felt good to be awful. Like looking down on the world from some great height.
"I will take my leave,"
Adir said, drawing himself up.
"Perhaps some night you will cast open your window and hear my song and recall tonight."
He went back to his friends, and I felt terrible for hurting him.
"He will want you all the more for not getting you,"
Locke whispered in my ear, pressing his lips against my throat. "I don't care," I said. "I'm going home."
"I will escort you,"
he said.
"If you like."
"Yes." I gathered my robe around me and began to walk, not waiting for him to lead the way. I don't know how I felt. I could barely describe it. "Why did you want me to do that?" I asked finally. The woods were so quiet, and all I could think was that Locke had shown himself to me. That's who he was. The person who engineered Adir's pain. Friend to Cardan and Nicasia and Valyrian. Peas in a pod. I had been a fool to love him.
"To show you what you would not otherwise believe,"
Locke said.
"Envy, fear, anger, jealousy. They're all spices."
He laughed at my expression.
"What is bread without salt? Desire can grow just as plain."
"I don't understand." He put a finger against my mouth.
"Not every lover can appreciate such spices. But I think you can."
He meant it to be flattering, but I wasn't so sure that it was. I ducked my head, twisted away from him. He didn't look upset.
"I can show you a version of yourself, Taryn. One you've never imagined. It's terrible to be a girl trapped in a story. But you can be more than that. You can be the teller. You can shape the story. You can make all of fairy love you."
I hated that it was so easy for Locke to guess the deepest, most shameful desire of my heart. "And before you judge me, I know you want it too. I see how you look to Madoc for approval. I see how your gaze rests on them, The envy. The wish to be seen as special. Don't tell me you wouldn't do a lot to win the love of Fairy. What would I have to do?
Put aside your mortal ways and your mortal qualms.
Despite my misgivings, when he came and kissed me, I clung to him. And when he urged me down to the forest floor, I was glad to forget everything else. I stretched out, breathing in the sweet scent of leaf mold all around us. As I finally fell asleep in the late morning, with the sun so bright, I had to close the drapes and press my pillow over my eyes, as a new story looped in my head. Once there was a girl named Taryn, and she was beloved of a boy named Locke. They were the companions of the youngest prince of Elfheim and his friends, the talented Valyrian, and the beautiful Nicasia of the Undersea. When they arrived at revels, courtiers turned their heads to see the magnificent cut of their gowns, to see the cunning cut of their jackets, and everyone who saw them adored them, especially Taryn, who was the best and most beloved of them all. Your tournament was soon after. I warned you. No good could come from defying a prince. But the thing was, you'd been indoctrinated with a stupid idea of honor from Matic, which basically translated into an unwillingness to back down, and a belief that winning was more important than surviving. And you played this game the same way. I came late to the stands. I didn't want to be there. Even though I'd told you that participating would bring nothing but sorrow, I had no expectation of you listening, and I hated to watch. But Vivi was going to go, and if I didn't, you would have taken it the wrong way. We were already arguing enough. So I sat in a gown of blue, listening to the crowd howl, seeing the cream-colored banners whip through the air, and I got ready for the spectacle. You didn't disappoint. You hit Cardin so hard that I thought you cracked his ribs. But it was your practice sword that broke. You knocked his friend Valyrian into the dirt. It was like some madness took hold of you. I thought you were unrestrained before, but it was nothing to this. Vivi cheered wildly. Princess Raya, one of Cardin's sisters and a friend of Vivi's, looked on with delight of a hunter watching the dance of predator and prey. I clutched my hands together in dread. After the tournament, I rushed from the stands, sick with worry. But Prince Cardin had already found you. He'd grabbed you by your hair and was snarling into your face. You'd been too good out there. Anyone could see that. Just like anyone could see why he hadn't wanted you to compete in the first place. You were mortal. You weren't supposed to best the children of the High Court, no less make it look easy.
There's nothing you can do,
Locke said, coming up behind me. He's going to hurt her, I said, glancing back at Princess Raya, hoping she might intercede. But we were far from the stands, and she was in deep conversation with my sister anyway, barely glancing in our direction.
He's a prince of Fairy,
Locke reminded me.
And Jude, well, let's watch and see what she is.
Beg,
Prince Cardin ordered you.
Make it pretty, flowery, worthy of me.
For a moment, you looked like you might. Locke's eyes were alive with interest. Why are you looking at Jude like that? I asked.
I can't help it,
he said, never taking his gaze from you.
I'm drawn to trouble.
I recalled what he'd said about jealousy being a spice, about giving up mortal ways and qualms. Locke left me there. He left me and walked over to you, my sister, my impulsive twin who seemed to be willing to make every stupid choice in the world. The one with the tail that was still unfolding.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. This is supposed to be an apology. I made a lot of bad choices, I know that.
You were tired of being picked on. Tired of bowing your head to them.
You were probably tired of being tired.
I get that. But it made it extra hard to keep on bowing my head when I was the only one. And Locke. Locke saw me differently than anyone had seen me before. He'd given me a taste of what it was to love, to want, to desire. And it made me hungry for more. I didn't want to give it up.
That doesn't justify what I did, though.
Come riding with us,
Vivi said, indicating Princess Raya. Even though she was royalty, her chief joy was riding out in the forest, hunting with her companions. I believe Vivi and Raya were drawn together by a mutual lack of interest in propriety.
Yes, come, said Princess Raya. Are you any good with a bow?
Middling, I returned, unable to turn down the invitation of a princess, even though I knew I couldn't sulk the way I would have liked. And oh, I wanted to sulk and feel sorry for myself and cry. I hated the way he looked at you. I wanted to eat all the clotted cream and jam in Maddox's kitchen.
The folk don't love like you do.
I thought of my mother, wandering through the rooms of Maddox's stronghold, slowly coming to realize that she couldn't bear being there, how she made a plan to escape him. I thought about how good it must have felt when you hit Prince Cardin with your practice blade.
So, tell me about this Heather,
Raya said to my sister as we rode.
Is she really worth living in their world of filth and iron?
Vivi laughed.
You know I like it there.
Raya's lip curled slightly.
Well enough. But the girl?
The first thing I noticed about her was that she had a smear of blue ink on her nose,
Vivi said.
The second thing I noticed were her eyes. The color of darkest amber. When she spoke, I was afraid she was talking to someone else.
Raya snorted.
What did she say?
Vivi smiled with the memory.
I want to draw you.
Ah, said Raya. An artist.
You should bring her here, I said, although I was only making trouble. Artists are beloved of fairy.
Ah, what a fine suggestion, said Raya with a big laugh. How happy I am you've come riding with us.
Vivi looked less pleased.
I think I will keep Heather to myself for now.
Love is greedy,
Raya said, drawing her bow. She'd spotted a bird high in the trees and chosen it to be her quarry. Her words bothered me, although I suppose my love for Locke was greedy too. But love was also transforming. I knew that from fairy tales. It could turn you back from a cat or a frog or a beast. Probably it could turn you into those things, too.
You can make all a fairy love you, Locke had said.
Vivi fell back to ride with me as the princess set off on the hunt. Our horses drew side by side.
Why are you angry with Jude?
Vivi asked. I suppose there was no hiding the way I had looked when we watched the tournament. And, I mean, you know how I felt. She's the one who's angry, I said. She's angry all the time. And she makes everyone angry at both of us.
Sometimes it's easier to be mad at the people close to us,
Vivi said,
than to be mad at the people who deserve it.
Princess Raya shot 3 small birds and cooked them over the fire. We ate them with soft cheese and a bottle of wine.
I was so hungry, I licked my fingers afterward. Chewed on the bones.
Vivi noticed and gave me half her bird. When I demurred, she rolled her eyes at me. It still wasn't enough. That night, Locke came to my window and called for me.
but I pretended to be asleep. I was too hurt, too raw. I didn't want to hear whatever he would say to me if I asked about you. He called and called, but I wouldn't go down. Finally, he gave up. And yet, it was impossible for me to rest. After an hour of tossing and turning, I threw on a cloak and sat on my balcony. I listened to the night owls calling to one another. Then music started up near the Lake of Masks. I heard a singer begin a tune I hadn't heard before. A song of heartbreak. Of a girl who walked the earth by starlight. Whose aspect was mortal, but with beauty divine. Her cruelty had pierced his heart. I was listening to a deer, singing about me. Luck had been as good as his word. He had shown me how to make fairy love me. He had shown me how to be the shaper of a story. He had done more than that, even. He had shown me how to achieve something like immortality. I sat there in the dark for a long time, listening, and then I turned around and walked to Locke's estate. You've been there, I know, so you've seen it. Like a fairy tale castle with a tower of the sort Rapunzel might have been imprisoned in. During the day, it's pretty, but in the dark, it was intimidating. Be bold. Be bold. With a shudder, I drew myself up, wrapped my cloak more tightly around myself, and knocked on the heavy front door with all my strength. I saw a light blaze in one of the high rooms, and I knocked again. The door opened, and a thin, tall creature, a servant of the house, I presumed, opened the door. I would see Locke, I told him, with as much haughtiness as I could bring to bear. Be bold, but not too bold. He gave me a steady look, and I stared back, trying not to notice how pale and sunken-eyed he looked, like one of the dead. But then he swept a bow and indicated, without speaking, that I ought to come inside. I was brought to a little parlor that was shabbier and dustier than I'd expected. Another servant, this one small and round, brought a decanter of some purple liquid and a small glass. When Locke finally came into the room, I was coughing, because it turned out the purple stuff was very strong. His hair was mussed from sleep, and he wore a thin shirt and soft-looking pants beneath a dressing gown. His feet were bare on the stone floor.
You came here,
he said, as though it had never occurred to him I could do that. I suppose that's one good thing about being obedient and faithful and good. People think you will never surprise them. Yes, I said. I think I understand now. What you meant when you said I had to give up my mortal qualms. And I am willing to do that. But I want you to marry me.
Ugh.
He sat down on the couch, looking stunned with lack of sleep.
And so you came here, in the middle of the night.
I hope that you love me. I tried to sound the way Oriana did when she forbade us to do things. Stern, but not unkind. And I will try to live as the folk do. But you ought to marry me even if neither of those things were true. Because otherwise, I might ruin your fun.
My fun?
He echoed. Then he sounded worried. Then he sounded awake. Whatever game you are playing with Nikasia and Cardan, I said. And with me. Tell Maddock we're to be wed, and tell Jude about your real intentions, or I will start shaping stories of my own. I thought of the brothers in the story of Mr. Fox, cutting the villain to pieces. It came to me, standing on my balcony, that with their inclination to violence, my family would need a lot less provocation to turn on Locke. As a deer's song drifted through the air, I realized that Locke might teach me lessons. but he wasn't going to like what I did once I learned them.
You promised,
he began, but I cut him off. Not a marriage of a year and a day, either, I said. I want you to love me until you die. He blinked.
Don't you mean until you die? Because you're sure to.
I shook my head. You're going to live forever. If you love me, I will become a part of your story. I will live on in that. He looked at me in a way he'd never done before, as though evaluating me all over again. Then he nodded.
We will marry,
he said, holding up his hand.
On three conditions. The first is that you will tell no one about us until the coronation of Prince Dane.
That seemed like a small thing, the waiting.
And during that time, you must not renounce me, no matter what I say or do.
I know the nature of fairy bargains. I should have heard this as the warning that it was. Instead, I was only glad that two of his conditions seemed simple enough to fulfill. What else?
Be bold, but not too bold, lest your heart's blood should run cold.
Only this,
Locke said.
Remember, we don't love the way that you do.
I know that I should have been a better sister, that I should have given you some warning. But some part of you must understand. All I had to do was keep my mouth shut and put up with anything he did until Prince Dane's coronation. Then he had to tell you the truth. Then he would be with me forever and love me until he died. So you see, I am sorry. I really am. I didn't think he could win your heart. If it makes you feel any better, it was agony to watch you with him. To see you laughing as the three of us sat on the blanket at the palace school. Your hand in his. I was anguished seeing your blushes and shining eyes. Jealousy wasn't a spice to me then. It was the whole meal, and I was gagging it down. But I am not our mother, and I am not going to make her mistakes. I won't turn back. I know what I want. I want Locke. I'm not afraid of his secrets. And you're going to forgive me. You have to. You're my sister, my twin. You've got to understand. If I just explain it right, I know you're going to understand. And I'm going to keep standing here and practicing it in the mirror until you stop looking at me that way when I finish.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of The Lost Sisters, written by Holly Black, read by Caitlin Kelly, produced by Christine M. Farrell. The Lost Sisters is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette Audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2018 by Holly Black. Audio production copyright 2018, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.